This is the Elevate Podcast, where trial lawyers learn, share, and grow. Let's talk about how we can elevate our trial practices, law firms, and lives. And now, here are your hosts, coming to you from coast to coast, trial lawyers Ben Gideon and Rahul Ravipudi.
Today's episode of the Elevate Podcast is being brought to you by Smart Advocate. Smart Advocate is award-winning case management software used to manage personal injury, medical malpractice, MDL, class action law firms all over the United States. Great program, highly recommend it. Check them out at smartadvocate.com. Today's episode is being brought to you by Expert Institute. Expert Institute is the place to go for everything involving experts to help you win your case. Check them out at expertinstitute.com. And today's episode is being brought to you by Hype Legal. Hype Legal is a one-stop shop for all of your digital marketing needs. Check them out at hypelegal.com.
Welcome to the Elevate Podcast. I'm Rahul Ravipudi.
And I'm Ben Gideon. So Rahul, recording 2 days in a row. It's great to see you this morning.
See you too.
Right before we went on air, you were mentioning this portal that your firm does that people can log into, and there's lots of content for education and trying to help lawyers perfect the craft of trying cases. Can you tell us what that is and how do we access that if we're interested?
Yeah, we call it the playbook, and the website is psbrplaybook.com. And what we decided to do, and this really started with the pandemic, when we were all locked down, it was one of our missions to really take the extra time that we have and try to take all of our knowledge and share it. And we initially started with webinars. And while we were doing that, we were building out our new website, the PSBR Playbook, where we were going to have professional videographers come in. And they were going to film us talking about different cases that we've worked on, different techniques that we've utilized to get verdicts, jury selection techniques, law and motion issues. And now the standard operating procedure in our office is anytime something interesting or new has happened, you brought a motion, you argued it, other people thought it was a difficult motion, and you actually got a good outcome. Just get into the studio, film for 5-7 minutes and educate about it. And then it makes it up onto the playbook. This playbook is really just for plaintiff lawyers only. So it really gives us the privilege and the ability to share it in a way that would educate plaintiff lawyers and not feel like you've got to kind of be half muzzled when you're in those events where you've got plaintiff lawyers, defense lawyers, and other people around. So it's been really cool. It's been very well received. And if you are a plaintiff trial lawyer, you should join. It's going to cost you $0. It costs $0. It's totally free.
Oh, that's great. I've been the recipient of some of the work products and materials you've sent over to me very generously and kindly in reviewing, for instance, your voir dire or Brian's voir dire in different cases has been really invaluable to me and helped me model some of the approaches that I've used. So I can imagine with all that content, that would be really helpful. And it's great that you're doing that and sharing it. So folks should definitely check that out. On that note of sharing, our guest today, Alan Tittle, is a lawyer from Cleveland, Ohio, who I met at the PSBR Trial College out in Los Angeles about a year and a half ago. Welcome, Alan.
Appreciate you having me.
So before we get into, you just got a great verdict and we were interested in hearing more about that and some of your other cases, but I was interested in looking at your biography on your website. You have a kind of a unique background. It must be true, but it says that you were dropped on the doorstep of your great, great aunt and uncle when you were 2 weeks old.
That's right.
And they raised you. So tell us about that. And how did that help turn you into the person and trial lawyer that you are today?
Yeah. So my biological parents, they were teenagers when they had me, 16, 17, some substance abuse issues. So at the time, they needed, for lack of a better term, a short-term babysitter. And so they sort of dropped me off at who I call Mom Pa's house. And it was also Ma's brother, so my great-grandpa, and grandma. So they were sort of tag-teaming. And what turned in, you know, was supposed to be sort of this short-term situation turned into the rest of my life until they passed away. And so being raised by folks who were, at the time, they were in their 60s, mid-60s, it allowed me to get sort of some old school values. I think that's really invaluable. They grew up sort of that what we call the greatest generation. And I wouldn't be where I am today without them, certainly. But also, you know, the sort of unconditional support and love they provided was unmatched. So I think that sort of helped give me the backbone to sort of go up against these giant corporations and not really think twice about it, which is something we all have to do every single day.
And did you develop a relationship with your biological parents over time?
Yeah, so I did as I got older. I don't want to get too complex here, but my great grandpa, who was sort of sharing the responsibility, actually died when I was 4. He dropped me off at Ma's house. I look out in the driveway and he has a massive heart attack in the driveway and his truck goes out of control. So that happens when I'm 4. And at that time, then my biological parents sort of start to get in the situation where now I'm splitting time between the two. And the substance abuse issues never went away, right? So I would go from half the time in the, you know, most loving house in the world, then the other half of the time into a tough situation where it was rundown apartment, sort of alcohol was always an issue. And so I would go from, I mean, there were nights where we had to go drag my dad out of the bar at 1:30 in the morning, 2 a.m., you know, as I was this little 7-year-old, to Mom Pa's house. So it was really a stark difference between where I would go to and from, but I wouldn't trade that. I mean, I think that all these sort of situations and chronicles that you go through in your life help mold you. And that way, when things get tough, you can handle it. It's like, oh, what's this? This is nothing. And so I appreciate it. And today I still have, my dad's better, still likes to have a few beers, but my relationship with him is much better than it was in the past. It also makes you sort of realize that, like, look, folks who have personal demons, it doesn't make them a bad person either. And so my last trial, the main plaintiff who had the brain injury was an alcoholic. And so that's something I had to deal with, not only throughout the trial, but in jury selection. When I was able to talk about it, I was able to talk about it from the heart. And so these life situations, they mold right into trial.
Yeah. Wow. That's quite a story, Alan. And do you think that that background also helps you relate to your clients who are down and out and experiencing hardship and difficulty in their own lives, you know, in a way that's really authentic?
Yeah, absolutely. Not only sort of the situations that I went through, but also the downside of being raised by old people is that they pass away, right? And so I've been at the bedside holding their hand when they die. I've been there. I've sort of walked in the shoes of sort of these traumatic situations. And so I know how they feel deep inside. Now, the flip side of that is it also can present some challenges, meaning I know myself personally, I may not be as empathetic as someone hearing a sort of tragic story for the first time because I've seen it all. And so that's something I had to work on was my own empathy, because going through all these traumatic situations in your personal life, you hear a situation and you're sort of like, ah, so what? And so that's something I had to deal with. But I also think coming from a unique background allows you to relate to juries. And so it's not like I was born with a silver spoon, so I can talk to folks on a real level, which I think puts me at an advantage than others. Or maybe I'm just not smart enough, so I can't use big words. I don't know. One of the two.
But also your background of hardship prepared you for a lifetime as a Cleveland Browns fan.
That's right. That's right.
It doesn't get any harder than that.
No.
Wow.
As we were filming this.
Especially with your quarterback going out for the season, you told me.
Yeah.
We're not supposed to talk about football, I know, Rahul, but I couldn't resist.
Wow. I mean, I just want to compete on who's got it harder. I really feel as a Bills fan, I've got it harder. But
I don't know. You got Josh Allen. We got nothing.
Oh, man.
Fawn's out for the season. We just got the news. So,
Oh, man.
What can you do?
So did you always, I know you at some point started your own practice early on. Was that always the plan for you? You were going to become a trial lawyer and go out on your own and take on the Goliaths and the big moneyed corporate interests of the world? Or how did you get to that point where that's the career you've chosen for yourself?
That was always the plan from law school. So two things really shaped that. You know, after your first year of law school, if you do well, you get to do like this fancy interview program in the fall, right? So, you're in top 10%, you get to interview with all these fancy firms. So I go and interview with the fancy firms. And I am talking to these people. And eventually I just march into a career planning. I go, I hate every single person that I've talked to so far. I cannot see myself doing this whatsoever. And I was like, so what's some good plaintiff's firms in the area? And she gave me a name and I cold sent my resume. And that's sort of where I clerked during law school. And then during law school, I always sort of knew that I was an entrepreneurial type mindset. Like eventually I want to do my own thing. And fortunately, my law school, which is a small law school, had this sort of roundtable of where they brought in two plaintiff lawyers who had their own firm to talk to, you know, sort of talk to any law student who wanted to have an interest in this could show up. So I go in there and I walk in the room and I sit down. I'm the only person that showed up out of the entire law school. It was just me. I'm looking around. I'm like, I can't believe this. Am I really the only one that wants to start a plaintiff's law firm in the future? But that was always my goal. I think I needed to learn sort of some skills before I did that. I couldn't imagine jumping right out of law school and handling medical malpractice cases. But that was always my plan from the beginning.
When you say your plan, was that always to do medical malpractice cases or plaintiff personal injury or something else?
It was always plaintiff personal injury. And I sort of fell into medical malpractice based on the firm that I worked at initially. And then you sort of get a taste of it and you're like, man, this is hard. And there's a reason why not many people do medical malpractice. And so because it was hard, it was something that I was attracted to. And so there you go.
And when did you open your own firm?
So I did that in 2015. The firm that I was working for split up, essentially. So now at this point, I had worked for two firms that have partners have sort of split up. And I'm like, you know, this is crazy. The time is now. Maybe it was a little premature. I don't know. But at that point, I felt confident that I could source enough business to get something going. So I started the firm in 2015 and never looked back.
Is there a case that I know you always wanted to get into this profession, but is there a case that you took on, win, lose, settle, but it just the facts or the client just made you realize and look back and say, this is exactly why I'm doing what I'm doing. And you made all the right decisions to get there.
Yeah. So there was a case early when I started in my law firm where a kid, I call him a kid, I mean, he was in his early 20s. He was diagnosed with the hydrocephalus, which usually you get diagnosed earlier, but for whatever reason, he didn't. And so there's this really usually benign procedure where they just put a shunt in to allow things to drain out and you're good to go.
And just so people understand, not everybody may know what hydrocephalus is.
Yeah, so it's essentially water on the brain, right? And because there's water on the brain, you got to get that water out. Otherwise, you're having headaches and you have pressure. Not a good situation. And so during the procedure to put that shunt in, basically the blood supply to the brain got cut off due to positioning. And he became essentially a vegetable. He was a permanent vegetative state on a ventilator. And we got that call and the kid was in a bad situation, meaning at this point, he was in and out of ICUs constantly. He was really on death's doorstep. And that ended up being the biggest issue in the case, quite frankly, was his life expectancy. But we were able to get the case resolved, and his mother, who who lived in Florida, was able to take him home to Florida and get everything set up in her house. And since that time, he's actually made a remarkable recovery. So he went from literally death's doorstep, couldn't communicate whatsoever, to now there's days where they can communicate through blinking. And he hasn't been hospitalized for a couple years. Now, people might say, well, wait a minute, doesn't sound like a good situation still. True. But not only did it allow Wesley to be able to survive, live, but it gave his mother an ability to live. So at the time, she had flown up from Florida and was now essentially sitting at his bedside, either in the nursing home or the hospital, every single day. Her life stopped. This resolution allowed her to not only get the best care that her son could have, but to get her life back. And so I think one thing that some people may not realize who don't do what we do is that not only do these cases, these catastrophic injuries affect the person who's injured, but it's everyone around them, everyone around them. And that is something that we have to think about as we're trying these cases, is what's it like to walk a mile in their shoes, but not just the person, but the family as a whole.
That's such a moving story, Alan. And it's strikingly similar to a case we just handled. And I felt like the hardest part of my case, and it sounds like maybe of your case would be the same, it was the perception of hopelessness. There was no amount of money that would be able to do anything positive for the individual who is in that vegetative state, if you want to call it that. And as an aside, I recall we might have even been at the meeting that we were at together or somewhere else. It might have been a focus group, but a bunch of people somewhere criticized me heavily for utilizing the term vegetative state. They thought it was very offensive, and I, to some extent, agreed. But it's also the common phrase that people tend to use, and it's descriptive of what it is. So I get that. But I was just curious, your story is interesting because you did provide the money did provide a benefit and help. In our case, we resolved the case for a lot of money, but the individual is still in long-term acute care setting because she requires machines and things that can't be performed at home. And there's that question of, and why are you prolonging somebody's life in misery like that? And there's just a lot of interesting issues that play into that. I'm curious how you dealt with that in your case.
Yeah, I mean, that undoubtedly is the biggest issue. In our situation, we really focused on the family, right? So like the story that we could tell about the mother is heartbreaking. Her husband, her life in Florida was put on hold. But also, you know, we could always talk about with modern medicine, you don't know what we can get down the road. And if someone would have asked me in 2018, hey, is Wesley going to be able to communicate whatsoever? The defense would say, no way, there's no chance. But he's doing it now. And so these steps forward, they're baby steps, but it's huge in the life of someone who they're locked in there. They're still there. But you have to paint a story that if you don't provide this help, you're sending someone a death sentence. And if someone says, well, isn't the death sentence better? I don't know. When you're locked in a body that, you know, you could come out of, I wouldn't want to die. I mean, that's sort of the way I would approach it or did approach it.
We'd like to thank the sponsors of the Elevate podcast, Steno, national court reporting service that allows trial lawyers to defer the costs of court reporting until the end of the case. Take a look, steno.com. And by Law Pods. Law Pods is the podcast production company that we use to produce the show, that produces podcasts for lawyers all over the country. They have an expertise in podcasting and the law. Check them out at lawpods.com. Do you want to tell us a little bit about the case that you recently tried to verdict?
Yeah.
And kind of how you got from the early phases of that to the way you presented it at trial successfully?
Sure. So this case was in a rural community where you can count on your hand how many times there's been a medical malpractice verdict. And there's been even less medical malpractice verdicts against the only hospital in that county. And so going into this case, I knew sort of the defense mindset was you're going to have to try the case. Why would I settle it? We win almost every single case that you try in this county. So have at it. And so from the very beginning, and by the way, this is the county where I grew up in. I felt like I sort of had a, I don't want to call it a cheat code, but I knew the perceptions of this only hospital in this community. And the perceptions weren't well, even though the hospital thinks that they have this great reputation. They really don't. And so from the outset, we had to figure out why this happened, the system failure. And I think you have to answer that question in every medical malpractice case. At the end of the day, why did this happen? And so that was really the approach, is not only do we have to figure out, all right, the actual negligence, but why did that negligence occur? And we were able to do this in this case by focusing on policies, procedures, training, things of that nature. And I'm happy to go into that in a little more in depth if you'd like.
Why don't you tell us the background, the facts, so we can understand?
Yeah, so this is a hospital fall case. And guy goes in, he's got a newly diagnosed heart condition, diagnosed with AFib, potential heart attack, 72 years old. And by the way, he's an alcoholic, smoker, all the bad things that us plaintiff lawyers have nightmares about. And because of that, they have to put him on 7 new medications. And a lot of these medications have some pretty severe side effects. And some of those set medications, by the way, was for alcohol withdrawal. And so they put him on these 7 new medications, and they deem him a low fall risk, meaning he only gets standard fall precautions. He can get up, walk on his own, no issue. That's sort of their approach. Now, their policies dictate that they have to do a fall assessment every shift, every 8 hours, which would include in checking someone's gait, how they would walk, and then also orthostatic blood pressure. So if their blood pressure would change if they stand up. And that was really the key in our case, is they didn't do those things. And so when someone has 7 new medications, all which can cause side effects that could cause you to fall, what do you think would happen if they don't assess if those medications is causing that person to be able to fall? They fall. So that's the case. He falls, going to the bathroom by himself, hits his head, has a massive brain bleed because he was also now put on blood thinners. He had to be life-flighted to a bigger hospital in Toledo, emergency brain surgery on a vent for 2-3 months, long road home, then the skilled nursing, and eventually he goes home, and that's just sort of the beginning of the battle. And this malpractice occurred in 2018. This trial was in 2023. And so that entire story of what occurred during those 5.5 years is pretty tough to talk about. His wife, who is actually about 20 years younger than him, had to quit her job, is now a full-time caregiver for him. He today, you know, he can walk a little bit with a walker, go to the bathroom, but he's pretty much homebound in his chair. And so this was a guy, if you think about it, say he's an alcoholic. Well, the guy had a lot of fun. The guy could have a lot of fun, and now he can't do anything. And so that's sort of the case in a nutshell.
So how did you deal with the alcohol issues, and how did the defense try to use that to attack your client and minimize the case?
Yeah. So, you know, the defense lawyer in this case is very good. He's lost very, very, very few cases. And so he was smart enough not to throw it in their faces, you know, all the time, but instead he would talk about life expectancy and that essentially, look, these health problems that he had, it's because of the drinking and the smoking. And so I think the way I was able to take the wind out of his sails was in jury selection. I would just flat out brought it up. I said, look, my guy was an everyday drinker. He smoked cigars. They're going to want to talk about this. Does anyone here feel like if someone's drinks, if they smokes, they can't be a victim of medical negligence, of medical malpractice? And then I got people talking, well, if it has nothing to do with the malpractice, why should it matter? And that's really what we want. We want the jury to think, right? But if their mindset's, if you don't address that head on in jury selection, their mindset's going to be completely flipped. And so I think from that outset, when their mindset was already, it has nothing to do with the malpractice, why are we talking about it? And then they're bringing it up, you know, every time they bring it up, they're thinking, well, why, this is crazy. Why are we talking about it? So that's how I handle it.
How did you get around what I'm assuming would have been one of the central defense arguments is that you see in every fall type case that falls happen, that not all falls can be prevented or avoided. And no matter what lengths you go to, sometimes people still fall. I'm assuming that was kind of the core defense into the case.
Absolutely. They would say, now they did say that every chance they could.
So how did you deal with that issue?
Yeah. So I think it's about proper alignment in the very beginning. So if your case is aligned, then at first, hospitals have a duty to prevent falls, especially when the medical treatment they provided created that fall risk. So that's the lens then that the jury is viewing the case, and that the hospital has to do something to prevent falls. And so if you can show then that the hospital ignored the risk signs of fall risk, that they actually caused the medical treatment, which was required, which was needed, caused this person to be a fall risk, and they did nothing about it, that they violated their own policies, that this assessment's required, this no, all right, what do we need to do here to keep this patient safe, was not carried out, you could sort of tackle that. I'm a big fan of, and it took me a little while to learn this, but you know, you can't tell a jury what to think. Can't do that. Every time you do that, they're going to think the opposite. Instead, you present that the facts, and then essentially you ask questions. What do you think is going to happen when someone gets 7 new medications, all that can cause someone to fall, and they don't do anything to make sure that the patient isn't going to fall? Obviously, everyone's going to answer that question. I think that's sort of the best way to tackle that defense.
Did the defendant and defense counsel argue that the hospital did not owe any duty to protect your client from a fall after giving 7 meds?
In a way. So the way they would do it is they would argue, well, look, it was not foreseeable that this patient would fall. It wasn't foreseeable. And because it wasn't foreseeable, we didn't have to do anything. But I think it's important then to sort of have your own case frame. Right. And so the counter case frame to something like that is sort of what I just said. All right. When you give a patient 7 new medications, all that can cause someone to fall, you got to do something about it. And so they certainly tried to argue that, but we would make sure on cross to ask. So let me get this straight. You gave this patient 7 new medications, all with a laundry list of side effects, and they're on the lowest level of fall precautions that a patient can get. Meaning a 16-year-old that's coming in for whatever, strep throat, is on the same fall precautions as this guy. Yeah, that's right. And so when you're viewing it from that lens, it's sort of like, this is insane.
And then how quickly after your client got the 7 medications, did he fall?
So this was, he was admitted on the 23rd, he fell on the 24th. So pretty quick.
And then were there, in the facts of your case, was there ever a time where they observed him more? So on the 23rd, they give him the 7 meds and then they see him ambulate, or was it all this low level of supervision from minute one?
That's an interesting point. So on the 23rd, there was this nurse who had been a nurse for 40 years. She still deems him a low fall risk, yet writes that he needs an assist to the bathroom, that someone needs to be with him. That's what she did during her shift. But after she left, and sort of the newer nurses come on, that goes away. So everyone says that low fall risk, he's up on his own, he can do whatever he wants. One big issue in the case was, so he fell at 10:40 p.m. His wife got there and watched him ambulate at 9 in the morning, and he could ambulate fine. And so they always wanted to make that big point. Our counter, of course, was a lot of these new medications weren't started until the afternoon. So it's pointless. Like that whole watching him walk in the morning is meaningless because it was before a lot of these medications. But that certainly was an issue.
Were there a turning point in the trial or a particular witness that you think was the most important in you achieving your outcome?
Yes. So as you guys know, trials like a roller coaster. jury selection and opening, I thought went great. And then our first two, which I don't really like to do, but our first two witnesses were our experts. And so I do like to have my first witness as someone who can give the rules. And sometimes that's the defendant. But just because of scheduling, the judge took a little bit longer with all the breaks than we thought. We were like a day behind before the trial even began. So we have to put out these two back-to-back experts. And they did not do well in cross. And I'm thinking to myself, this is it. 4.5 years down the drain. This sucks. But I think cases generally turn on cross-examination. And so as we started calling the providers as if on cross, that started to turn the case. And then their experts, we filleted them on cross. But I think the biggest turning point was actually the system failure. So we, during the pendency of the case, I took a 30B of their corporate rep. And as in most medical malpractice cases, they said their policies and procedures, they're just guidelines, right?
I love that. It's such a gift, isn't it?
Yeah, they're just guidelines. You know, they don't need to be followed. And so what we did then at trial is polarize that to the extreme. And so during cross, I pulled up their index of the policies and procedures. I started going through them. Nothing in here is mandatory according to Firelands Hospital, right? And then I go right to the safety patient, all the policies related to safety. And I go through them all, nothing mandatory, right? And I get to the last one, says right site, right patient surgery. Meaning you got to have the right patient you're operating on, right? And now, so I want to just make sure we get this straight. There's nothing in here that's mandatory to make sure that the right patient's getting operated on, right? Right.
Come on.
They agreed with that?
They agreed with that.
Oh my gosh.
And so then at the end, I got them to admit to completely sort of the whole point of the system failure is if someone walks into this hospital and gets a nurse who's been a nurse for one day, and someone else walks in and gets a nurse who's been there for 40 years. Those nurses, using their discretion and not following the policies, you could get two totally different levels of care based on their nursing discretion. And they agreed. And that's what these system failure cases relating to policies and procedures are really all about, is at the end of the day, it's the luck of the draw when you walk into the hospital, because you don't know who you're going to get. And if you happen to get the people that are new or just not as skilled, sucks for you. And that's what the case was all about.
That's really well done. I mean, there's so many lessons to take away from that. And some of those techniques are ones I'm definitely going to steal from you, Alan. We try to put the system failure case together in every case, but I really like the way you framed that of the comparison of the day one nurse and the 40-year nurse. It really brings that point home so well. And it is astounding to me because that approach they take to their policies where they characterize them as merely guidelines or some other descriptor that makes them voluntary obviously defeats the entire purpose of having policies and systems, right? And so once you get that admission, going down that road like you did and polarizing it in that way is just incredibly effective. And it really calls out the lie of what that is. It's so crazy to me that that's the approach they take rather than acknowledging that these policies we really do care about patient safety. Look, we've developed policies on these issues. We have committees. We think it's really important. That's why we develop these policies. And in this case, this particular policy, we agree it was violated, but sadly, it probably wouldn't have made any difference here because if they had assessed properly, all the evidence is that they would have found that he was ambulating fine and it wouldn't have led to any change, right? You could have defended the case that way and still accepted the policies as being mandatory and important, but they never do that.
No.
It's such a crazy thing, but that was really well, the way you framed that was really terrific.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
What was the verdict?
So it was 6.19 million, which is the largest verdict ever against that hospital system. You see nationally sort of these 40 million verdicts. And, you know, those don't happen in Ohio. So this verdict, though, I think will make some real change in the community. And I know for a fact that this hospital system has already made changes to their fall policy and will keep patients safer in the community because this family, you know, the Johnsons, my clients, were had the guts to stand up and do something about it. And at the end of the day, that's what these cases are all about.
It's fantastic. And you know what? Like that first story you talked about with your client who went to Florida, that money's going to really help your client and his wife have a better future and a better life.
Yeah, absolutely. He was a Ford retiree. And so it's not like they had all the money in the world. And this is going to be able to give them the care that he needs. They're going to be able to make the changes to their house to make it safe for him. And it will allow his wife to have a little bit of life again, which is really important.
Well, terrific result, Alan. Thanks for coming on the podcast and sharing it with us and some of the lessons gleaned from it that are going to be valuable for everybody to follow and think about as we try our own cases. And good luck going forward. I hope we connect sometime soon, somewhere.
Absolutely. We'll have to go to the Panish Trial College again.
I love it. I love it.
I'm there.
Hey, Alan, if any of our listeners want to reach out to you, what's the best way for them to reach you?
Yeah, so my email is just my last name, Tittle@TittleLawFirm.com, or give me a call, office 216-222-2222.
Thank you.
For more information about today's guests and the topics discussed on the show, please visit our website at www.elevate.net. That's ELAWBATE.net, where you'll find guest profiles and show notes, and you can continue the conversation by joining our Facebook group. And if you enjoyed today's show, we hope that you'll subscribe and consider giving us a 5-star review. So for now, keep on working to elevate your trial law practice, and we'll see you back again soon.